afternoon. The woman had been depressed. Police received a call from the woman's employer at about the same time hospital security spotted a woman in the ramp. Schaefer took over negotiations with the woman after the officer's male counterparts failed to make much headway. The woman is now under observation. Chicago police say a small plane has crashed into a home on the city's southwest side. Police spokesman Ron Gaines says the single-engine plane crashed into the house around 2:45 this morning. Gaines says the occupants of the home were not injured, but he did not know about the condition of the person or people on board the plane. Fire officials told local news outlets they were still searching for the plane's pilot. A Federal Aviation Administration spokeswoman told the Sun-Times the small cargo plane, an Aero Commander 50, had just departed from Midway International Airport on its way to Chicago Executive Airport in Wheeling when the pilot reported engine problems and tried to return to Midway. The plane crashed about a quarter mile from its departing runway. In northwest Wisconsin, jurors in Chippewa County have convicted a man who died before the verdict was announced. A jury found 37-year-old Jamie Lanera guilty of sexually assaulting a 14-year-old girl in 2012. What the jury did not know at the time was that Lanera had been found dead in an apparent suicide at his home earlier that day. Lanera attended the first day of his trial Wednesday, which continued the following day despite his absence. Court personnel were privately notified of Lanera's death after the defense made its closing arguments. The Chippewa County Assistant DA handling that case says he did not want jurors to know of the defendant's death so the victim and her family could have closure. The judge in the case informed the jury following the verdict that the defendant had died. WGTD News Time is 8:10. In sports in the NBA, the Bulls beat the Clippers last night 104-89. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service. Partly sunny skies today, a high around 18. Then some light snow developing after midnight tonight, continuing at times tomorrow morning. Not much in the way of accumulation. We could pick up an inch or two. Then for the weekend, warmer weather on the way with highs bouncing back into the 40s, but we could see some light rain at that time as well. Right now in Burlington, 6 above 0. In Kenosha, it's 9, a wind chill reading of minus 8. Winds out of the west at 15 miles an hour, gusting as high as 23 miles an hour. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The morning show with Greg Berg is coming up.
And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTDHD, Kenosha Racine, Elkhorn and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. I am so glad to be able to welcome back into our studios Dr. Art Sear, director of the Clausen Center, Clausen Distinguished Professor of World Economy at Carthage College, author of After the Cold War, and someone who joins us on a monthly basis to offer his analysis of current events here and around the world. And there is an exceptionally long list of important things we need to be talking about today. So, Professor Sear, without too much further ado, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, thank you, Greg, for a warm welcome on a cold morning.
It is a cold morning. And certainly a lot of the headlines right now are pretty cold as well. I think we should start there, actually.
Not if you're a Republican, Greg.
How's that?
Republicans did pretty well.
Well, absolutely.
Some people accuse NPR of bias. I don't know why, but there is some good news in terms of partisan politics.
We'll get to that in just a moment. Let's start with the Middle East, of course. And, of course, we're speaking in the wake of really disturbing news out of Jerusalem with an exceptionally horrific terrorist attack at a synagogue in Jerusalem where four people were killed, and there have been other attacks, of course, there, and much unrest in the region, chiefly at the hands of the Islamic State of Iraq and Greater Syria, otherwise known as ISIS, and the latest beheading. There are lots of terrible headlines out of that part of the world right now. And in the wake of that, I thought it would be a good opportunity for you to maybe make a point again that you've made before on this program and made in a very recent column about how no matter how terrible the individual headlines might be on a day like today, that that in fact we need to keep a long-term picture in mind when it comes to this region. And that long-term picture, in your view, is actually pretty positive.
Well, the column dealt with the growth of democracy over the last 250 years, which is the really long term, and it's not particularly reassuring with terrible headlines in the news. In terms of immediate wider context, the attacks in the Jerusalem synagogue were like beheadings that you referred to by ISIS. They're designed to have maximum impact in our day of 24/7 relentless news cycles, news companies driven by profit more and more above all. I don't minimize the horror of such events, but the number of people involved, including in the terrible and despicable murders in the synagogue, are relatively few. And that gets at an important, I think, wider immediate point. Take a look, whether it's the Middle East or Ukraine, which in many ways I think is a more dangerous situation strategically for us, and Afghanistan and elsewhere. How many people are in fact being killed and wounded, and how much territory is being controlled? If you are going to pay attention to the news, one good antidote is to turn off the news at least for a while and to spend more time with serious print publications. The dispassionate analysis is always the best. And that's maybe more reassuring, especially for younger listeners, than some old guy referring to the last 250 years when not even I was around.
Right. One interesting report on NPR yesterday about ISIS was quite intriguing to me, and I'd be really curious to hear your response to this. They were saying that one of the things that has made the ISIS hard to pin down and for us to directly attack is the fact that, to a large extent at least, they are, in a sense, staying off the grid with their communications and so on. And that when they do that, then it becomes harder for us to detect them because they're not leaving a trail of cell phone calls and emails and so on. But on the other hand, when that occurs, then that indicates also then some level of disruption in their activity.
Yes.
I mean, if they're not able to communicate with each other via email or cell phones or whatever, that in a sense blunts their effectiveness. It's just really intriguing because I think a lot of us don't stop to think about the way in which warfare is being waged in those kind of ways, and that those kind of technological matters are really crucial in a lot of ways that most of us just don't stop to think about.
It shows the importance, among other things, of human intelligence. We rely so heavily on electronic intelligence. I had the good fortune of being at a conference over the weekend of an organization, ACTC, in which we're heavily involved, which supports the humanities. And we had esoteric discussions about the importance of the classics, where Carthage has particular strength. And starting with President Woodward, we've been consistently very supportive of this kind of activity. We started talking about the British and their emphasis on the classics, and then we started talking about intelligence. The British have been enormously influential beyond the size of their population and their geography for several hundred years because they put such heavy reliance on human intelligence. That's not esoteric at all. Especially today, we rely as heavily as we can on electronic surveillance in the U.S., and I think some of our failures reflect the difficulty of pursuing human intelligence, and also a desire to shy away from this area as much as possible. I think that's been a weakness of our foreign policy since the George H.W. Bush administration, that is, starting with Clinton. And it's something that I hope we will address, and one of the productive things the new constellation of power in Congress can do is address this. President Obama has been extremely aggressive in using drones for kills of individuals, the target, plus ancillary damage. And I don't want to debate that or discuss it in detail unless you want to, but a corollary of that is that we've minimized even more human intelligence on the ground as much as possible, and wide-ranging intelligence. The president seems to have a focus, and has said that he does, on direct threats to the homeland, direct threats to the United States, along the lines of the horrific 9/11 attacks. Well, if we're going to remain safe in the world, we've got to go beyond that and work the human dimension, as frustrating and unpleasant and ugly as that is. Intelligence is, if you really do it right, is dealing with a lot of unpleasant and a fair number of really crazy people who are often your best agents, no matter where you are in World War II or the American Revolution or Vietnam or our current struggles.
Speaking of this region of the world, one of the most important developments, and this is also, of course, the kind of thing that tends not to get a lot of attention in television news, for instance, is the role that Turkey is playing. And you've talked a lot in your visits here about how significant Turkey is in this part of the world, and the fact that recently Turkey voted to allow Kurd forces from Iraq to cross over the border into Syria to battle forces of ISIS there. Remind us about sort of our relationship to Turkey and just how critical a role that they are playing in this part of the world right now.
During the Cold War, we've generally been close allies. Turkey was an ally of Germany and the other Central Powers in World War I. They were smart enough to stay neutral in World War II until the last year of the war, when they came in on the side of the Allies. As this implies, they've historically not only been an Islamic country, which gets a lot of attention, but also very, very close to Germany. Turgut Özal was probably the most important of a series of friendly leaders of Turkey to the U.S. He had a particularly close personal rapport with George H.W. Bush. He was a significant reformer. I believe he was an honest man. And that partnership was vital during the very successful, increasingly impressive in retrospect, first Gulf War, when we drove the Iraqi army out of Kuwait. Turkey played a pivotal role because of geography, but also temperament of the leadership. At that time, they let us base U.S. B-52 bombers on Turkish soil. The government of Turkey was strongly and understandably opposed to Bush II's invasion of Iraq in 2003 and refused to cooperate in any way with the U.S. We wanted to send our armored forces across Turkish territory into Iraq, and they said no emphatically. Prime Minister, now President Erdogan's government is also a fundamentalist. I think there are some advantages to us, actually, in that, but they are opposed to us, in a sense, temperamentally. There's also a fair amount of corruption and erratic behavior at the top in that government. Nonetheless, geography is undeniable, and we can talk about that more if you wish, but Turkey's geographic position, as well as their pivotal position politically as an Islamic population, but a secular, still, I believe, secular, constitutionally governed state, puts them kind of at a crossroads between East and West. Mm-hmm. That's an old cliche. It's more true now than ever. They were having tense relations and some combat with Syria long before ISIS, before the Syrian civil war really got serious. The Syrian Air Force shot down a Turkish aircraft, and the pilots were killed. It's a little uncertain how, I think in 2010, before the region really heated up as a result of the current civil war in Syria and the ISIS threat. Turkey has remained in NATO. They've worked within the context of the Western alliance vis-a-vis Syria, and they're not only permitting Kurds, an ethnic group that is a source of some instability and domestic threat in Turkey. They've not only let Kurds cross their territory, but of necessity they've been grudgingly but steadily more cooperative in the Allied effort to support the Kurds in Iraq and Syria. It's always complicated, but it's the main point is extremely important for us to get along with the Turks if we can. And history indicates that we can, not only in the first Gulf War, but also in the Korean War. The Turks were extremely vitally supportive of us. Hmm. Like the Germans, they have a powerful warrior tradition. You really don't want to fight these people if you can help it. Angela Merkel's very effective, stable, and positive leadership of Germany, I think, means that today we should be reinforcing German-Turkish ties as well as our own ties with Turkey.
One of the things you said just now that was very interesting to me is when you said something to the effect that this is a fundamentalist state or fundamentalist government, and that could, in some ways, works to our advantage.
Yes. Well,
how so?
Well, we're concerned. The media, of course, greatly exaggerates the threat, especially in this country, in the way we characterize Islam generally. However, Islamic fundamentalism, extremism, and Islamic-based terrorism is a serious problem. Insofar as Turkey is, in terms of population, an Islamic state, but constitutionally, again, Erdogan keeps pressing the limits, but constitutionally they've maintained overall the rule of law. Hmm. They have elections that are relatively honest and mean something. The population is in no way drawn to extremism. In fact, Al-Qaeda and other terrorist incidents have boomeranged in Turkey. All of that means it's a way into encouraging democracy in the Islamic world.
And so, in other words, that's another way in which they're a gateway, as you were saying before.
Yeah, in a very real sense. And a contemporary point, the main point of that op-ed you quoted, I referenced Sam Huntington's book, not his famous The Clash of Civilizations, but another book on the third wave, the long-term trend toward democracy. I think we should see the Middle East and turmoil in the Islamic world generally as part of the very difficult, painful, and rather violent revolution toward democracy that started in the modern world with the French and American revolutions. And started with the English Civil War back in the 1600s, actually. But he really focuses on France and the U.S. and then developments from there.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Professor Art Sear, director of the Clausen Center. Clausen, distinguished professor of political economy at Carthage. And he joins us once a month to offer his analysis of current events. We'll spend some time in just a few minutes talking about the recently completed midterm elections here in the United States. But since we're abroad, so to speak, right now topically, that's where we're going to stay for a little bit longer. Things certainly were interesting and at some points pretty tense in the recently completed G20 summit, which took place in Brisbane, Australia. Mm-hmm. And among the interesting things I read was about the relatively isolated figure of Vladimir Putin. Mm-hmm. During those proceedings. I mean, he was the target of some pretty frank criticism, and one had a sense of just how serious this situation was just by the way he seemed to be sort of viewed and treated at this G20 summit. I don't know if you want to comment about that or anything else that occurred there.
That's another point that has really broad implications. I'm glad you brought it up. We don't have global government, to reassure your listeners, including especially, of course, Republican listeners. Traditionally, we do have a governance network. Nation states still control military forces, and that's a reality of international life. But since early in World War II, we've had a commitment to a framework of institutions with the UN at the top that do a lot that's positive of an economic and especially non-military sort, humanitarian relief, coordination of communications and transportation activity of all sorts, coordination of global shipping. And the G20, along with the European Union and the NATO alliance, represents are important dimensions of this broad framework of cooperation that's different from the way the world was before World War II. Russia has a structurally weak economy, as President Obama quite rightly has emphasized, and the fact that their stock market, their currency, has been weakening since Putin has been relatively belligerent and physically aggressive in the Ukraine. Hmm. But also, I think, starting with the invasion of Georgia in 2008, a somewhat similar situation, we have lots of economic leverage. The sanctions that have been imposed on Russia may or may not be strong enough, but the reality is you don't have to do a lot. The extraordinary, indeed revolutionary, expansion very, very quickly of tremendous oil and gas, not only exploration but production in this country, means we're becoming independent and increasingly important major exporter of energy resources, a position we haven't held since 1960. And we've all heard the debate about U.S. energy dependence. As long as we have discipline at the top of our government, we can use this strategic leverage to counter Russia's energy leverage, especially in Europe. We have tremendous resources of all kinds at our disposal, and Putin is isolated and weak for that reason.
Hmm. You mentioned the last time you wrote about Ukraine, and this is a point you've made before, but it's worth making again, I think. The fact that Putin's attitude is, in a sense, deep-seated, and really his belligerency, in many respects, springs out of a sense of vulnerability, and not just Putin individually, not really Putin individually at all, probably, but just Russia itself, given recent history. We can understand why they might feel some political vulnerability and this need to expand their borders just for the sake of their own safety, something that we don't always stop to think about.
Historically, they have been vulnerable and felt very vulnerable on their western border. They've insisted, understandably, on friendly countries, especially to the west, but it also has some bearing on their involvement in East Asia, but it really is very direct and immediate and territorial in the west. Since Barbarossa, the almost unbelievably massive and initially effective Nazi invasion of the Soviet Union, starting in June of 1941, they have been paranoid about their borders. When I worked in Chicago at the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations, you'd see this directly with visitors, including very senior diplomats, as well as academics from the Soviet Union. That is a point I keep returning to. George Kennan, K-E-N-N-A-N, one of the most important thinkers in our country and policymakers in our country, but also of broad and international consequence. If you really want to understand Russia and our relations over time, read his. He was enormously prolific, given that he was working at other things through most of his career. He is really an insightful source, and I'd be glad to suggest chapter and verse to anybody who wants to get in touch with me at Carthage. He originated the containment policy, which guided U.S. foreign policy starting with Truman until the end of the Cold War. Putin himself is by no means weak. He's a very tough guy. He's a very ruthless man. He's very, very smart to survive the way he has at the top. He's a killer. He earned his bones working for the KGB in East Germany. The KGB absorbed the most effective and evil elements of the Nazi regime. They were more pervasive than the Gestapo. He is a very, very tough individual. And the kind of silly public relations, taking off his shirt and this macho posturing, tends to be a distraction for us. It contributes to gigantic popularity in Russia. This guy is very, very popular, as well as durable, and what remains a very tough, brutal political system.
Speaking of brutal, we also have headlines out of North Korea about various reports of human rights violations there. And I think it's actually today that a committee at the United Nations is meeting to discuss the possibility of making some rather official sort of pronouncement that really wouldn't carry the force of law at all, but might be kind of a powerful statement of condemnation against some of these human rights violations which are going on in evidently in North Korea at the moment. Is this something new? Is this something significant?
Well, I don't know. I'm just an academic, my friend. I'm very good at predicting the past. But they do seem to be doing things. They're under tremendous long-term economic pressure. Their population has suffered so much, and on such a sustained basis, it has to have an impact even on these people. And members of the elite are starting to suffer. They have recently returned to U.S. hostages, high-profile people who they arbitrarily took. One of these men, I believe, the evidence is pretty clear, he has some pretty serious mental problems. They did not execute them. They didn't send them to the gulag. They did try them and convict them, but they've been very moderate and prudent compared to the way they used to handle Americans and others, Westerners and South Koreans, whom they've grabbed with no public preparation. There must have been private contacts, but a pretty high-level delegation, including the top security advisor to the leader of North Korea, suddenly appeared at the end of the Asian Games, which were held in South Korea, and there was very friendly dialogue with South Koreans. Again, it's on again, off again, since our nuclear agreement of 1994 with North Korea, which we violated initially. They did not. The U.S. House of Representatives and Republicans, led by Newt Gingrich, they upended that agreement. But the North Koreans have been very unpredictable, and I don't think we should be anticipating any kind of huge sudden detente or breakthrough vis-a-vis the Soviet Union and China. Dwight Eisenhower advised patience as a form of courage. He was particularly explicit in discussing not North Korea, but Taiwan mainland relations during his time in the White House, especially the armed conflict over Quemoy and Matsu. Patience is a form of courage, and patience is the best approach to North Korea. Again, we have the high cards.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Artsir Clausen, Distinguished Professor of Political Economy at Carthage College, Director of the Clausen Center there, and he is joining us today for his monthly visit to the morning show. Not too long ago, of course, some midterm elections took place here in the United States, and of course...
Oh, yeah.
remember something about that. And, of course, it was a rather spectacular success for the Republican Party across the country, not only congressionally but gubernatorially as well. The map sure has a lot more red on it now than it once did. Were you surprised by the extent of the Republican success in this most recent midterm election? I mean, obviously, all the predictions were that to some extent it would be a good day for them. Did you expect it to be as spectacularly a good day as it was?
I'm certainly impressed. I was surprised, people generally were. They ran ahead of the polls, which reflects a variety of things. Certainly turnout, as the president emphasized, but it also reflects President Obama's and the Democrats' unpopularity. Every president who's able to make it well into a second term has had serious trouble, including FDR, who was elected four times. But it also means your second term, even Ike, who was very, very popular, but had problems, including a big Democratic win in 1958 in the Congress, something that President Obama alluded to. I think the parallels aren't exact, but the general, they're very different in many ways, but the fact that presidents have trouble in their second terms is pretty continuous.
To what do you attribute that? Why does that keep happening?
It's a tough job being president. We're not we have never been a deferential people. We don't like authority. I think since the war, the fact that the presidency, thanks not just to FDR, but to the longer sweep of American history and leadership, the president's becomes such an enormously powerful figure. The president's also an enormously attractive target. And we expect, even Republicans expect Washington to make things okay, take care of us, help us out if there's a national disaster like Katrina, which really hurt George W. Bush. We want the president there helping us out. We want Washington to have demonstrable positive effect on the economy. That's a modern development. Along with the power of the modern presidency, modern Americans, we really look to government to take care of lots of different things, and even conservatives look to government in that sense.
So when the government doesn't quite manage to follow through, it spells trouble for the president then?
And his party. Yes. Well, yeah, and we have a long-term slogan. We have an economic recovery, undeniably, and we're a very wealthy country overall, but we have a sluggish recovery. There are a lot of people who have had a vexing time getting and keeping a job, getting and keeping a job that's satisfactory. And again, a large percentage of our population, the boom times of the 80s, the boom times of the 90s, that's how they grew up. Our expectations are vastly higher. Even young people have been around old people older than I am, the grandma and grandpa who can be tiresome but also fascinating and talking about how tough things used to be, especially in the 30s. But also our expectations in life in the 40s, 50s, into the 60s was very different from the 80s and 90s.
So now we have, what you're suggesting is we have, to some extent at least, unreasonably high expectations.
Well, we have high expectations. No, it's important to have high expectations, but we look to the government in a way that we didn't to solve these problems long term. Herbert Hoover was the most admired, most popular man in America, most popular person in America, probably. People who weren't interested in him, he was an extraordinary hero. A big reason for that was humanitarian relief after the First World War. An even bigger reason, he was a very gifted executive, unlike most people who achieve high political office. In 1927, the Mississippi River overflowed its banks far more than usual, and there was vast flooding throughout the that enormous river basin. Secretary of Commerce Hoover, Republican, orchestrated a gigantic relief effort, unprecedented in scale, although Theodore Roosevelt had done some things that anticipated this, and it was crucial to his enormous victory in the 28th presidential election. But from that time on, we expect the president and the federal government to handle these things, these natural disasters. Hurricane Betsy in 1965, I think, was the first hurricane in the Gulf that did $1 billion worth of damage. It was not as the scope wasn't as great as Katrina, but it was big. Lyndon Johnson, you were referring off the air to this new book about him and Reagan. Lyndon Johnson was there physically at 3 and 4 in the morning. The President of the United States was sloshing his way through the bios with tense Secret Service men and exhausted, unhappy local politicians in tow. He was banging on the door of shacks, shining a flashlight on his own face and saying, "Your president is here." FDR and the New Deal greatly built on Herbert Hoover's very admirable precedent. And Johnson insisted, in great contrast to the Bush administration and Katrina, Johnson insisted that there be immediate follow-up. And his capacity, at least for a while, to drive the entire federal structure is just incredible.
So what does that have to do with this crushing defeat by so many Democrats?
Well, we were talking about the state of the economy, and people are unhappy. President Obama is an unpopular president. I think people feel, at some vague level, but they feel the government should be doing more to make this a more prosperous, enjoyable economy. That's what that's, what he's saying. I'm not. We don't have another gigantic hurricane that's nationwide. No, we don't. But this is examples of how our attitude has changed over time.
Right, right. Nationally. Well, and what I'm reminded too is of President Bill Clinton. In some respects, the reversal of his fortunes from downward to upward, in terms of his own popularity. Some say stemmed largely from the Oklahoma City bombing, the fact that that came at a moment in his first term when high expectations were very disappointing and a lot of people didn't view him as presidential at all, and then that Oklahoma City bombing occurred, and it was suddenly a moment where the president was center stage and really took that spotlight and in a very meaningful way was exactly the kind of figure of reassurance that you were talking about just now, and that was a moment when he really shone, and it made a difference. And in a sense, it seems like what you're describing is a scenario now where President Obama is not, for whatever reason, representing that kind of reassuring figure or reassuring presence for a lot of Americans.
That's an interesting reference to the Oklahoma City bombing. I hadn't thought about that before. But I will. Clinton's ability to exercise executive leadership, a good bill and a bad bill, more dramatically than sometimes is the case, is his ridiculous personal behavior got him in trouble. But as an executive, he was actually quite effective. Like Lyndon Johnson, he was a great deal maker in Congress. He had tremendous Republican support, which got the NAFTA treaty at the beginning of his term. And the Asia financial crisis, the bailout of the Mexican financial system, which was collapsing. In each case, Clinton demonstrated tremendously energetic executive drive as well as political skill. I'll have to think more about that. That's a very good point you make.
Right. Well, the fact that for all the successes that he maybe enjoyed, he enjoyed very few at very beginning of that first term.
Oh, yeah, and he was going to lose. It was guaranteed he was going to lose in 96, right. and then he pulled it out again.
Yeah, sure did. Well, at any rate, the Democrats did not pull it out in this midterm election, so we have a U.S. Congress that is decisively controlled by Republicans, both in the House of Representatives and the Senate, and of course we have a Democratic president. So what is likely to happen now in the next couple of years? Much of anything?
Yes, I do think that if the Republicans want to recapture the White House, they're going to have to demonstrate leadership, and I think Mitch McConnell, who apparently does not want to be president, which can be an advantage. He wants to be a great Senate majority leader. An awful lot of the progress that has been made, especially when we've been up against the wall in terms of government shutdowns and the fiscal system falling apart, McConnell's ability to do deals, along with Congressman Ryan and Democratic Senator Patty Murphy of Washington's ability to do a big bipartisan deal, has been crucial to keeping our system functioning today. And I would pay attention to individual Republican congressmen and senators and the committee chairmanships, they win. Paul Ryan is being challenged, apparently rather seriously, for the Ways and Means Committee chairmanship. It's a very powerful position, and not surprisingly, people, more than one or two, are interested in it historically. How that plays out, given his very, very important, serious policy influence in the House, who emerges in the Armed Services Committee, Foreign Relations Committee, intelligence and others related to foreign policy is going to be very important in the new Congress. Mm. Good news is that there is a growing bipartisanship that's driven by the increasing number of women in Congress. I heard in the media, including NPR, that we now for the first time have 100 women members of Congress. Actually, it's the kind of thing academics love to point out, we had 102 briefly in the previous Congress and then went down below 100. Not as many as it should be. I'm sure there'll be more, but the female population is growing. And there is more of a tendency, I believe, for women legislators to work in bipartisan terms. They network more. They communicate more. It's a point I heard on PBS, the Friday Week in Review program. The positive influence, I think, of more and more women in Congress, as well as in executive branch positions, I think, is one leavening influence. It's also something that men participate in, too, the keep an eye on the senators and members of Congress who are from seriously challenged states where their position isn't secure. I think these people have been demonstrating bipartisan leadership.
The maybe primary issue right now before the Congress and the president, aside from the economy, is that of immigration. And of course, President Obama evidently has assembled what would be a pretty remarkable plan, which would, in a sense, rescind the deportation of millions of undocumented immigrants, illegal aliens, if you prefer that term. I believe a plan he hadn't really gotten around to announcing yet, but a plan which was leaked to the press and which has stirred up quite a bit of conversation. And, of course, the thought is that if he moves ahead with this, then the Congress faces an interesting challenge in terms of what they're going to do to allow all this to go forward or get caught in the without playing any meaningful role whatsoever in this really important and divisive issue of what to do about our undocumented immigrants. How do you see this playing out, and has it surprised you so far?
It's the same way that immigration politics has been playing out since the Reagan administration. We have an enormous number of illegal immigrants in this country. The Reagan, George H.W. Bush administrations provided, through executive authority, amnesty, which made things easier for dependents to become citizens. And the Democrats have been emphasizing these points, as well as a couple that you've made. I believe that in this area, as in others, the president's apparent the fact that the president is not engaged in regular conversation, dialogue, and negotiating with either party in Congress poisons the well. If Obama takes executive authority in hand and arbitrarily decides what changes should be made, this will probably destroy the possibility of any cooperation between the executive branch and the Congress. I think that is very destructive for our politics, and I think a much better approach is to try to get something together that everyone can agree on. We were talking earlier about Clinton and others' skills in this area. It's become immersed in partisan politics because Hispanic voters, like other ethnic and racial minorities, have been drawn to the Democratic Party in recent times. That that is a change from our history, but it means that the Republicans have a major challenge and the Democrats see a political opportunity. I really wish we could rise above that. We also, frankly, have an awful lot of cheap labor provided by these people and an awful lot of middle and upper income. Citizens in this country benefit from this underground economy. The most effective and, I believe, instructive example of dealing with a porous border occurred during the Eisenhower administration back in the 1950s, when we really emphasized not only effective law, but effective law enforcement. I'm doubtless sounding very conservative and stodgy. We should return to that attitude. We should return to that attitude, I think, but we're not going to, which means presidential leadership's even more important. But the way I handled this problem, as others, is very instructive for us today.
Let's finish by talking about historically low oil prices right now, which are translating into much lower gas prices at the pump than we've been dealing with for years and years. And it's nothing I think most of us are complaining about. Maybe those who make hybrids like Priuses are complaining a little bit, because that seems to be sort of driving down the popularity of those kind of vehicles. But in the meantime, most of the rest of us, at least for the most part, are pretty happy about this development, happy and surprised. Can you help us understand what forces have driven oil prices down so dramatically?
Of course, I can help you understand.
Thank you.
Peter Drucker, the famous management consultant, was good enough to meet with me twice. It was hard to get in the door to see him, frankly. He turned me down twice, but we wound up spending two separate half days together when we were planning the Clausen Center for World Business, and I didn't want to be late, so I got out to the Claremont Colleges, Claremont University, several hours early, which is a good way to address, you know, high-stakes appointments. And just being able to drop his name was remarkably beneficial in dealing with ARC. That's one reason I went there. You know, Peter Drucker, wow, what do we do next, ARC? And he was great company, and I could see why he made such a mark in life, in the business world especially. I killed some time before our meeting at a used bookstore in Claremont. I think it's called Claremont Books. Wonderful bookstore, an actual physical bookstore. Not virtual, not Amazon. And I found a book which I bought, I think, for a couple of bucks, on the future of oil in the world, published in the early 1930s. And in that book I read that there was great concern about the fact that the world was running out of oil. Texas, Oklahoma, also California, were identified as major world-class oil production centers. One reason we were so concerned about a Japanese invasion early in World War II, a realistic threat, was because of all this California oil. We're running out of oil. Experts in the 20s and 30s felt we were running out of oil. In the 70s and through the 80s, we're running out of oil. We're always running out of oil, in the view not just of media alarmists, but serious people, including geologists. That's part of the culture of exploration. And we always find more. So these big strikes and big discoveries are not surprising in the longer sweep of history. I do think in this area, as in others, there is a necessity as well as opportunity for both presidential and congressional leadership. Heidi Heitkamp, one of the female members of the Senate I was just alluding to, a Democrat from North Dakota, she has been particularly, not surprisingly, but particularly interested in and particularly